Welcome to another episode of the Lookout Podcast. I have the great pleasure of having Fred Cooper on today. Fred Cooper is a smoke jumper and author of this book, Smoke Jumper Experiment. Now, Fred, with this book, I thought, I'm like, how did I not know this existed? But it's pretty new. It's been out.
Yeah, it's been out 2 years now.
Yeah, I've seen that. Yep.
My partner, co-author, Mike McMillan, I had written a manuscript, kind of like on a thesis format with, 300 and some source notes. And yeah, it was not very readable, to the journal audience. So I asked him if he could help me. And he's a journalism, graduate and a smoke jumper also.
Oh, nice.
And he's now into, gone into firefighting with, for the Forest Service beyond smoke jumping. But he helped me and do the editing and rewriting of it. And plus he wrote an epilogue, that followed on after the experiment, with the talking about the Ram Air and how that came about and the use of it.
I thought it was very cool because, I thought maybe I just missed it. So when I was going, just kind of sifting through it for getting ready for this podcast, I didn't have time to sit down and fully read it yet, but... I got to the epilogue part, and I was like, oh, wow, 2021, talks about the completion of the Ram Air transition from round parachutes to Ram Air parachutes.
Yes.
And I was like, oh, all right. And then I looked at the copyright and said 2022, and I was like, oh, no wonder why I haven't seen this one yet. Yeah. It's pretty new.
Yeah, we had it out just in time for the Boise reunion in 2022. That we had national reunion we had.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Well, did you attend that, the national reunion? Did you make it for that one?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've been to, four or five reunions, and I'm on the board of the National Smoke Jumper Association. So,
cool.
I got a link to what all's going on with the community these days.
Yeah. It's a great thing to be a part of. One of my really good friends, Matt Weidman, jumped on McCall, and he's also from Whitehall like me. And he, when I first started the project, he's like, let me just do one favor for me. Just, get your membership for the NSA and at least, tie in with them and start talking shop. And I was like, yeah, I will. And then I put it off until this Man Gulch, reunion or, memorial, the 75th Man Gulch memorial. And I ran into, I think I was telling you, Kinderman.
And, oh, yeah.
And he, and then he got me tied in with Mike Bina and then started, talking about that. And they helped me, and I kind of helped Jeff set up the Man Gulch Memorial in Darby for Marvin Sherman.
Oh, yes.
That's how I got tied in. I was like, oh, man, I got to be a part of this program because even right now, I'd like to attend as many smoke trip events as I can, but definitely kind of like you in your retirement, go around and catch them all,
Yeah. Well, we've got a... NSA board meeting here in Missoula, October 23rd.
Oh.
And there's a big social out at the Museum of Mountain Flying that evening. So anybody that's in the area, general area, hopefully would have gotten a notice, about it. And Stevensville might be too far away from...
I didn't get the notice, but
zip code's a little bit too far away.
I think so, but this will help get the word out too for folks who are listening. So you said October
23rd. Six to nine that evening. Big gathering at the Museum of Mountain Flying.
Oh, perfect. And for folks who don't know, that is the newer museum right next to the airport, right next to the jump base, right?
Yeah. We're going to have we just broke ground for the National Museum of Forest Service History a week and a half ago. And, we plan on having, a 20,000 square foot, building there, hopefully by the end of next calendar year.
Oh, man, that's going to be great.
Yeah. And, smoke jumping will be a part of that history, but the Forest Service involves, so much, and it's, now 120 years old. So, there's a lot to tell.
Yeah, totally. And I don't think it was really getting out to folks, right? Everyone knows Ed Pulaski, and I don't even know if everyone knows Francis Lovekin, you know? Yeah. So it's important to have stuff like this. And I mean, I couldn't tell you the first Hot Shot crew even off, you know, top of my head.
Oh, well, the first Hot Shot crew, you raise that up, you know, that issue was the first experiment for the Hot Shot crew was the same year as the Smoke Jumper experiment in 1939.
Really?
There was a 40-person crew organized on the down at near Roseburg, Oregon.
Oh.
On the Umpqua, I think it was the Umpqua National Forest. And before that, if they needed firefighters, they would come all from bars and pickups and pick up in town, or construction workers, and they just weren't efficient at all in fighting fire.
Yeah.
So somebody, matter of fact, it was the forest supervisor at the time, said, "Hey, we need to do, something different about having people, involved with fighting fire." So he organized a first experiment that spring, and they proved that, hey, this is the future. Well, so that's what. That's how the Hot Shot crews came about.
Oh, wow. Man.
That's kind of a different story, but...
It is. No, it's cool. But, I mean, all connects, and, historically, Hot Shot crews kind of feed, the jump program and other, programs that, if people are following a different career in wildland, because it's changing a little more, because it seems like people are starting to have a little more turnover rates. But when I was younger, the Hot Shot crews... from squad boss up to foreman didn't really change that often, or up to supervisor. So you basically get on a Hot Shot crew to get a lot more experience, and then it also would boost your resume if you wanted to go anywhere else, like smoke jumping or rappelling or something else like that.
Yeah.
So or just act to a district and pursue like an AFMO position.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, the helicopter rappelling program came along, after that. Actually, helicopters weren't really used in the Forest Service until, a little bit, into the 1950s.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Yeah, they probably just weren't that great, Tom. So.
No, they weren't. I think it was 1934 or 35 that, they had an auto gyro. It was a forerunner of a helicopter.
I was wondering.
And, in fact, it was, I can't remember the guy's name, but they actually had somebody who had this Forest Service employee, had his first ride in a auto gyro.
Yeah, I was reading about that just last night, and it's at the front of your book. Is it? So I guess we'll go back to the book and start from the beginning. So the experiment started in 1939, and was it this?
Yes, yeah. And how how that came about, obviously, was, hey, the Forest Service recognized that we need to get people a lot faster to fires.
Yeah.
And so, be able to, what they use the term retard fires.
Oh.
And in 1936, the man who I consider the grandfather of smoke jumping was the name in David Godwin, and he was really in charge of fire in Washington, D.C. for the Forest Service. And, so in 1936, he had gathered up enough momentum and a little bit of money and had an experiment in California to drop water containers even some chemicals on fires to retard them, so they before they would take off, until ground crews could get to the fires.
Oh, kind of like a water bomb?
Yeah, they call them water bombs, with that they did that for 1936 and 37, and even into 38. And they did in 36 and 37 with rented or contract aircraft This is in Northern California. And they figured, David Gottman figured, hey, if we're going to have this successful, we got to get our own airplane. Yeah. So he was successful in the Forest Service acquiring and purchasing their first airplane. It was a Stinson, you know, a single engine aircraft.
Yeah.
And he got that, and it was delivered to to California, you know, with a pilot picking it up in Michigan, at the Stinson airplane factory, and David Godwin, or another Forest Service official said, hey, we can't have a silver colored airplane; it's got to be green. So, yeah, he ordered it to be green, colored green, and he had some term. He says the newspapers picked up on it and said, yeah, we got a flying air tank, engine.
Flying fire engine. Yeah.
Well, they tried that again. That didn't work, and finally David got him and said, "Hey, we got to transfer this up to we got some fires up in Oregon," and so he moved it up to Portland, Oregon, and they tried it for a few actual fires up there. And the Mount Hood National Forest, as a matter of fact, that wasn't successful. And the people that were working on it that said, hey, if we're going to ever get fires retarded or get them initially when they get going, we got to parachute, men, and it was men obviously then,
yeah,
into fires. We're working towards getting some parachutes. They put out a call for parachutes and issued a contract or the request for bids. And I've only been able to determine there was only one response to the request, and that happened to be from the Eagle Parachute Corporation in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. That individual owns that. Not only did he bid on it, but he came, to Portland, Oregon with some equipment later that summer and demonstrated it from showing it. He didn't, no jumping.
Yeah.
And he said, well, if you guys are interested, I'll provide some parachutes, a suit, and a couple of experienced parachutists to work with you. So he was issued the contract, and near as I can determine, they probably had a couple parachutes and maybe one or two suits that he had built.
On his garage or something?
Well, it was built. No, it was built by somebody in Portland, Oregon.
Oh,
gotcha. A company in Portland, Oregon, and it was a one-piece suit that was,
Was that with the big neck collar?
Yeah, it was a suit, one-piece suit, with a zipper front, so the smoke jumper could get into it. That's it.
Yeah.
And he could, and it was padded, and it was very, very difficult for the parachutist, to be able to maneuver.
Yeah.
But he did, and needed help getting into the airplane, and then also getting off too.
Oh man, I bet.
And then we can get into the experiment itself. It started in October. They said, okay, we're going to, try this out and see how it works. And the Eagle Parachute Corporation guy, what was his name? The owner of the corporation.
It wasn't Derry, was it?
No, it was, we'll come up with the name, but...
Yeah, I'll look it up here.
Anyway, he he had himself and two parachutists, one who was in he was selling his parachutes in California. His name was Frank Derry.
Oh.
And Frank was and then he had another parachutist with they were really daredevil parachutists, barnstormers. And they
must have been some wild men, because not too many people have been doing it, right?
That's right. Yeah, they would go to fairs and rodeos and collect, and the hat would be passed, and they'd collect $4 or $5, and they'd, you know, they were excited about going up for an airplane ride and jumping.
Yeah.
And the parachutes they jumped were just round. At that time, the experimental. Daredevil parachutists, they would judge where they were going to land by they'd drop a drift streamer, or they would see somehow they'd know how the wind was blowing, and they would and then judge where they were going to drop, so they'd be able to drop into the rodeo, middle of the rodeo grounds.
Whoa.
And that was but what happened is that, and you know, this is probably one of the main instrumental things that happened to make this program successful, was in 1938, a parachute, you know, designer, you know, had designed and built a maneuverable parachute.
Oh.
And it was named the Eagle Parachute, because he was able to, he partnered up with this guy, I can't think of his name.
Is it Beach Gill? So it's Beach Gill, owner?
Oh, yeah,
of Eagle
Beach
Parachute?
Beach Gill was the owner, yes, yeah. That's right, of the Eagle Parachute Corporation.
Yeah.
But this parachute was maneuverable, and in hindsight, that's what, you know, made the program successful. Because this parachute had a built-in forward speed of maybe 3 to 5 miles an hour, and you could pull on guidelines and turn it. It had a skirt that went up, flared up in the back.
Oh.
And it didn't have slots or anything like that, but you could steer, you could close the tail on one side or the other of the tail of the skirt that went out the back, and it would turn.
Oh, just kind of cause drag, maybe to.
You get a different wind drag.
Yeah.
So it wasn't real maneuverable, but it had a person, you know, jumping could steer themselves into a a better spot to land.
Yeah. Holy cow.
Yeah.
Those first daredevils, yeah. Wild men.
Yeah, and the suit, you know, it proved to be. It had a big collar up, you know, leather collar actually that went up, and the helmet that they used initially was an open cockpit pilot's helmet, either leather or a wool helmet that they pull over their head to, you know, primarily keep their head warm as they were flying, you know, in the open cockpit pilots.
Oh,
and. Well, and what happened, you know, also, how they got more people, Frank Derry, he made, on his second jump, the Eagle parachute opened really fast. It was known for having an extreme quick opening, and if you weren't in a good position, it would whip you around, you know, and either give you a big smart wrap on the shoulder, or in the case of Frank Derry on his second jump up this experiment, he was up, you know, he was on his side or twisted somehow, and he hurt his back.
Oh.
And so he had to end up going to the chiropractor to get, you know, squared away. And then the other parachutist was Glenn Smith. And Glenn, on his first jump, you know, he twisted, he got his leg caught on one of the shroud lines and he twisted his knee.
Oh.
And it was, matter of fact, it twisted so bad, he was not able to jump the whole, for the next 2 months, October, November, during the experiment. He ended up being the parachute rigger and repairing parachutes, you know, for the people that were jumping. And what happened is that Frank Derry got hurt, you know, so then Frank says, hey, he said to Gil, Gil Beach, that, hey, I've got a couple brothers who are also, they've done some jumping, not as much as me or Glenn Smith, but let's bring them on board. So, Gil agreed and he paid them. You know, they weren't Forest Service employees. Beach Gil paid them. Oh. I think it was $500 for the next, for the duration experiment. As a matter of fact, one of them, one of the Derry brothers did say $500. It was a lot more than I was going to be able to make hauling laundry, driving a laundry truck for several months.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a good chunk of change back then.
Yeah. So, these two guys came on board and they did some jumping. And about the second or third jump, one of the Derry brothers got one of the shroud lines, came along and whopped him on the side of the face and cut his face really bad.
Oh.
And he said in his internet later interview, he says, I was bleeding like a cut hog. So he wasn't able to jump for a few days.
Yeah.
But they ended up deciding, hey, we need to have a better head protection, and this damn suit's not going to work very well. So they had a harness maker in Winthrop, Washington,
oh,
with sewing equipment, and he, with the help of Frank Derry, designed and built a scratched out a prototype parachute, or a two-piece jumpsuit, and at the same time, and so he took, and then David Godwin took the Derry that was injured, to Seattle, and with this mock-up suit pieces that he'd made,
yeah,
and they had a manufacturer in Seattle,
yeah,
build a two-piece suit, and at the same time, the guys back home in Winthrop, they grabbed a football helmet, and they were able to
engineer it. Like,
and they used a catcher's mask, to put on the front of it, and that's what they were able to use, and that, they. The football helmet with the catcher's mask attached was the forerunner,
oh,
of the modern day, helmet and face mask that's used today. But obviously, there's been, many modifications, to it. But
yeah,
yeah.
Some of the guys when I rookied were still wearing kind of an old school looking helmet. It was the bigger kind of cue ball looking helmet with mask that was some of the guys had a mask that was like bungeed on, kind of like it had a bungee strap. So it it looked really hot. I did not want one of those.
It was kind of like this one here. Probably it was held up by bungees and then or snaps.
Yeah, real similar to that. Yeah,
that's a picture of me. At the dedication of the Redmond Air Center in 1964.
Oh, really?
Wearing it, yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome.
I was the poster boy for that.
Yeah, oh, cool. Yeah, great photo. I didn't mean to derail you, but they're onto something then with that new kind of helmet design, because I imagine jumping October, November, cooler time of year, the wool, leather helmets, wouldn't have really had an issue with them, but
no.
Come summertime, those would be real hot.
Yeah, they did. There is some reference to the fact that if the helmet was too big or a person's head was a little bit small, they could still wear this pilots, open cockpit pilot, cap underneath it to, fit a little bit better.
Oh, nice. Yeah. A little warmer for the shoulder season jumps. Cause as you know, like refresher still is kind of early in the season, so it could be a little cooler weather.
But so that, there was a lot of experimentation that took place during these, there were 58 jumps.
In 2 months?
It was less than 2 months. It was from October 5th to like the last week in November.
That's a lot of jumps, especially for experimenting, because you think you'd have a lot of, like after action review, after every jump,
they did recruit, the main jumpers were, the three Derry brothers. Cause, Frank Derry, after a couple of weeks, he recovered. And then they also had, and Glenn Smith couldn't jump, but then, there was a, kind of a daredevil, Forest Service employee named Dick Tuttle. Came along, and he also jumped several times.
Oh, awesome.
During the experiment.
Oh, I thought I heard a phone ringing. I didn't realize Tuttle was a Forest Service employee, because I've seen his name before. And how did Francis Lufkin get...
I don't have my notes right in front of me here.
Oh, yeah, no worries.
But there were a few others that jumped, but they mostly were just making initial one or two jumps at the airport.
Oh, gotcha.
Francis Lufkin on the next to the last day of the experiment, on kind of a dare. They dared him into jumping. He was primarily hired to climb the trees and retrieve the parachutes in case they landed in trees, and as well as the cargo, because he dropped cargo chutes initially to see how the silk parachutes would stand up into the landing in trees. Francis Lufkin and a fellow with him, they ended up they weren't hired by Eagle, but they were still Forest Service employees, and they went along and helped do the parachute retrieving. And they ended up making one jump apiece. Matter of fact, it was Dick Tuttle's brother, his father, who jumped. And,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And then the assistant fire officer on the Chelan National Forest. It was before the Okanagan, and he made a jump. Yeah. So I've reconstructed a jump log of all 58 jumps, using interview notes and also newspaper articles from the Methow and Okanagan newspapers.
That is cool.
Yeah. So I've got.
Because they didn't have that much. I think maybe they did have a detailed log, but maybe got lost or something.
Huh? I don't know. As they had really a detailed log. Yeah.
Yeah, because they probably weren't as concerned about who was jumping when, just more of like the performance probably and capability, right?
Yeah.
And then in your book here, it says at age 61, is it Lag was named leader of the smoke jumper experiment?
What's the name?
In 1936, Lag developed a parachute for delivering supplies from airplanes using burlap. So I thought he was jumping at age 61, but I guess he wasn't a jumper. He was just head of the experiment, it says. So I was like, wow, I mean.
Oh, yeah.
Am I saying his name wrong? Lag?
Yeah, he was. Lag worse. Worse. Yeah, he was the leader. He was the project leader for the experimental project. He spent a good 2 months during the summer of 38 developing plans, safety protocols, and getting equipment squared away. And yeah, he was a photographer and architect, aerial architect, not flying airplanes, but he packed gear and photography equipment up to peaks and ridges and photograph it, and then he'd take it back. But Whoa. He ended up being the planner, and he was leading the project. But within the first week, he was injured. Or matter of fact, injured. He ran up the hill to take some photos, and he had a heart problems.
Oh, no.
And he survived that okay, but he shortly after, he ended up retiring.
Yeah, I don't blame him.
He was 61.
Yeah, like I just kind of saw that at a glance. I was like, was this guy jumping out of planes at age 61?
No. There was one of the oldest guys to jump was, I think, 58.
Oh, gotcha. Was that Tuttle's dad? Is that what you said?
It may have. Oh, I bet it was. Mitchell, no.
And the reason why I say, like, that's an old age to be jumping out of a plane is just because of the technology back then. You know, I've heard stories about opening shock being just brutal.
Yeah, Roy. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Roy Mitchell. Oh. He was a Forest Service employee. As a matter of fact, he was the in charge of road maintenance and trails maintenance for the whole Chelan, Chelan National Forest.
Oh, yeah.
And he did make a jump, and he was the oldest at age 47.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah.
Still, I mean, they got to be put together pretty good to be jumping.
Yeah. And he retired just 5 years later, 1954, 30 years working on the forest.
Man, pretty
for
cool.
The Forest Service.
Road maintenance, then get to parachute out of a plane.
Yeah.
And then the Stinson plane, is that the same from the photo with Francis Lovkin in the jumpsuit?
Yes.
The same plane?
That's right, yeah.
Oh.
And that airplane was, like I said, purchased in 1938 for the Forest Service. But in 1940, the winter of 39-40, World War II was coming along, and the Forest Service, as well as all federal government agencies, were cutting back, and they surplused the airplane. And the best I can recall, it went to a company up in Alaska bought it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know I haven't researched as to when the second airplane was, Forest Service airplane was purchased, but.
I wonder.
It would have been well after World War II. Because World War II, that's kind of, that's getting on to another subject area, but the experiment was so successful that David Godwin, said, hey, I want regions 1 and 6 to now prepare for fire season 1940, and so they put together a bootstrap program and took off in 1940.
Very cool.
And of course the airplane was gone at the time, but Johnson Flying Service in Missoula, Montana. Provided the flying services, for the swamp jumper program.
Oh, gotcha. For both the two bases only at that point.
For the two bases, yeah. And there was, they flew from Missoula to Winthrop in early June of 1940, and trained 5 swamp jumpers. Qualified for smoke jumping, and Francis Lufkin was one of those.
Oh, cool!
Along with Dick Tuttle and three other guys, and they and they set up a smoke jumper base at the wind at the ranger station in Winthrop, and less than 5 miles away was the airstrip. So when they when Region 6 wanted to use the smoke jumper on a fire, they would call over to Missoula and sent and the airplane was sent over to to Winthrop.
Oh, gotcha.
And that occurred once during the 1940 season. 1940 and 41 were still considered operational experimental programs.
Oh.
They were operational, but it was still declared experiment. We don't know whether this is going to really work, boys, but we're going to give it our damnedest and try.
Yeah.
So in, like I said, the first part of June, declared, they had two or three practice jumps, actually it was two practice jumps during that, I think it was probably the first full week in June. And then on Friday, they had their annual fire guard school outside of Winthrop, and they set a test fire. They flew the guys out and dropped them, and that was their final
task or
final test. check jump.
Oh, check jump.
To declare them now swink jumpers, and they used the word swink jumpers then because during the experiment, one of the Forest Service guys said, "Hey." I'll get his name, but he said, now that we've got men jumping to fires, they aren't smoke chasers anymore. They're smoke jumpers, because smoke chasers were, would walk or ride to a fire and chase the fire. But now they were jumpers, so.
Oh, that makes sense. I never knew about the origin, but that makes
that's
a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's how smoke jumping got its term.
Ah, it makes sense. Yeah. And then I forgot to ask you about the auto gyro, because I read a little bit about that, and that was early in the 30s is when they were testing the auto gyro?
Yes, yep.
And it was kind of like a helicopter? And it could.
It was a helicopter able to. I had one blade for hovering, and then also a forward blade at an angle, still up, for being able to have a forward speed.
Oh, gotcha.
And of course, the controls were controlled by the pilot, but it never was able to hover 100% like today's helicopters are. It always still. I had a little forward speed to it.
Oh, gotcha. And must not have been that practical then, huh?
That's right.
Because I never heard about it.
Walt Anderson was the guy who coined the term smoke jumper.
Walt Anderson.
Yeah, he was the fire management officer, for the forest.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, and he also made one jump, Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah.
Man. Yeah. Be great to be that guy. I got to do a jump and name the program.
Yeah.
And then before we started recording, you read a letter that I think most smoke jumpers get a kick out of. Was it Regional Forester wrote?
Oh yeah, yeah. Prior to this experiment, there was an experiment. In Ogden, Utah, the regional fire control officer there was always looking for better ways of getting people to fire faster, and not better necessarily, but faster.
Yeah.
And so he recruited a sport daredevil parachutist out of southern Idaho, northern Utah area, and to try this experiment. So they over Ogden, Utah airport, they would experiment with low level flying, dropping a test parachute with a dummy, weighted dummy on the parachute, you know, over the airport, testing to see, you know, can we drop people over fires or over forest areas and successfully have them go fight fires. So they developed this airplane, redesigned one of the travel airplanes, opening in the bottom of it, and that with a ladder, short ladder, going down, you know, the bottom of the airplane, and this parachutist, you know, would climb down the ladder, and he was using a 28-foot parachute. And when the pilot thought that it was in the right position to drop me, he'd pull the lever, and the ladder would collapse, and the parachutist, you know, would drop down to the ground.
Holy cow.
And they did 20, 30 dummy parachutes landings, and, you know, to see how it would work. Well, so the fire control officer said, well, let's try this in real life. So he had and he convinced the parachutist to climb down this ladder, and they dropped him at 400 feet. And anywhere from 100 to 400 feet is where they were dropping the dummy parachutes. Nothing higher, but they wanted to get them low so they make sure they get them to the ground. Well, the report from this 1935 experiment was sent up to the regional forester in Missoula, Montana, because they were establishing a fire warehouse program in Spokane, Washington at the time.
Oh.
And it was going to be the headquarters for Region 1 having a fire program.
Yeah.
And so they had, and then when this report went up, he was asked, hey, how about if we have you guys continue this parachute project and see if it's the feasibility of it. So he wrote the regional forester, and Major Kelly was his name. He was from World War One. He was a major in World War One, and that's even though his name I think was Evan Kelly, but he was always called Major. And he wrote about a page and a half letter to the chief of the Forest Service and said, hey, quote unquote, all parachute jumpers are more or less crazy, just a little bit unbalanced. And he went on to say, I don't want to have anything to do with this experiment. But this is 1935, and you could fully understand, you know, when he was reading this report, you know, dropping somebody from 400 feet elevation, what in the, you know.
Yeah, what are we doing here?
Yeah, yeah.
Especially you heard about the ladder and everything.
That's right.
It sounds a little crazier.
But lo and behold, Major Kelly, you know, with the assistance of and convincing of the regional fire control officer here in Montana, he turned himself around, and he supported eventually a smoke jumper program.
Oh, awesome. That's great.
Yep.
Just had to get a little more info about it, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else you want to know?
Yeah. So, from there, I guess, Missoula, I think most people know, but for listeners don't know, Missoula claims the first fire jump, Earl Cooley and,
Rufus Robinson.
Rufus Robinson, yep.
Yeah.
And so they kind of claim the...
Yeah, and that was, and that's not only claimed, but it's substantiated. Yeah, it was July 12th, 1940. First official fire jump, first fire jump period, in the U.S. Forest Service.
Yes, yeah. So like you said, they do have the title of smoke jumper because what... The back and forth goes is that NCSB, birthplace of experimental jumping, is what,
but the first smoke jumper base was established in Winthrop, in June, into that first full week in June, because they had trained these five guys, and operational smoke jumper, parachutes were all already provided because they purchased the parachutes and radios for both Missoula and Winthrop. Earlier that year. So these suits, the new jumpsuits too.
Oh, awesome.
Johnson Flying Service flying over to Winthrop, Washington, that was the first operational, smoke jumper base. And then they, Johnson's flew back, to Missoula, and then they had about 9 or 10 recruits, Forest Service employee recruits here in Region 1. And then they began training once the second week in June, and they trained at Seeley Lake, Montana. And they set up an operation there and training base, and they also had an open airfield. They had an airstrip right at, just about a mile north of the village of Seeley Lake. And plus they had a wide open, huge range land, about 7, 8, maybe 10 miles at the most, south of Seeley Lake for their initial parachute jumps.
Oh, gotcha.
So they trained, them to... to these 9 or 10 men to jump at Seeley Lake, and then as I recall, it was like July 6th, right after 4th of July, they moved to Moose Creek Ranger Station in the Bitterroot National Forest and set up the second smoke jumper base in the Forest Service.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, and I think that the parachute packing loft shed is still there, I think, at Moose Creek.
Yeah, I don't know if it still is or not. I've always wanted to go in there, but I've never been in.
Yeah.
But they spent the first 2 days when the crew went in, out of trees, out of the raw lumber there, logs, building the loft.
Oh, gotcha.
They even used cedar to... split for the roof of the loft.
Oh, really?
And they, yep.
Yeah, I've seen photos, and I heard it was still there, so I'd like to go check it out too.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's on my to-do list for adventures. And then, and the reason why I was kind of saying the claim thing is that that was always the kind of sibling rivalry was between NCSB and Missoula on who was first.
Yeah.
And I guess for folks who don't know, in order to be considered a national smoke jumper, even after you're done with rookie training, and that is true today as it was when we jumped, I think, is you need a fire jump. Otherwise, you're not considered a smoke jumper, at least until you get your fire jump. So
that's news to me.
You never heard it? Maybe that's a newer thing, because that was kind of like the claim of how Missoula won the argument. Is that
no? When I rookied in 1962, I was after my seventh practice jump. I was given my, smoke jumper parachute wings. I was declared a smoke jumper.
Oh, really?
It
makes sense though, because that's when you're supposed to get your wings is right after rookie training, and then, they wouldn't let us get purchase any like smoke jumper gear or, I think they're calling us cadets or something. smoke trooper cadets or something. I can't remember what they're calling us until we got our first fire jump at least at NCSB, and I'm pretty sure all the bases are still kind of.
I never heard cadet term before.
Oh really? Yeah, something like maybe it's not cadet, but yeah, something like that. Because I was like, man, I really got to work for this jump. And then the rookie class before me, I want to say, had a really slow year, so I think a couple folks didn't get a jump out of NCSB, but they maybe got a jump somewhere else. So they're able to get gear from like Redmond, but they weren't able to get buy NCSB gear yet until they got their jump out of NCSB. Yeah, so that was that a thing when you were jumping then too? Did you have to get a jump out of that base in order to buy the swag from that base?
No, no.
I wonder when that started.
I don't know. We never had a, you know, back in the 60s, we didn't have a flag.
Oh yeah, huh? No.
It was a T-shirt. That's about it. And yeah. I don't think we even had T-shirts with the base emblems on them at that time.
Oh really? Oh yeah. Now everyone's got their own gear locker, so you can buy it. Like Redding has mugs and all kinds of stuff with their logo on it, and same with AK. Everybody pretty much now. But I wanted to ask you before I forget. The original loft was getting washed away at NCSB because of a great flood, right?
Yeah, before I was there, the loft was over initially next to the Metha River.
Yeah.
And that would have been in 19, probably 42, 43, something like that, it was established. And they even had, I think, a tent or temporary quarters over there for the pilot or jumpers to, to be ready. And, but at any rate, they had a bad flood somewhere in, the late 40s and washed that area out. So then the base was moved over on the other side of the airstrip.
Yeah,
where it is now.
Oh, good. Because that's what I was told. The airstrip didn't really move; just the base did.
Just the base. Yeah.
Yeah, and the way I was told it, and I'm not sure if it's true because no one has been able to confirm this information, but that Francis Lovkin was working his butt off to get the sewing machines out of the building because they're about to lose it.
That's what Bill Moody. Yeah.
That's who I heard from. Yeah.
I don't know if Bill was involved. It was there. I don't know. I doubt if he was there when, as a matter of fact, I'm sure he wasn't, because I don't think Bill started jumping until 57.
No, and that's, and because I interviewed Bill, and he couldn't tell me exactly what happened, because the other information I got was that after he got everything out of there, like the sewing machines and things, he set fire to it so it wouldn't cause any problems down river. So, yeah, he burned it. Supposedly started burning it down before it washed away and could block anything down river or cause any problems. And I'm not sure if that was true. And Bill hadn't heard that before. So
Bill would have, had firsthand knowledge of that, working with Francis Lufkin for many years.
Yeah, and he hadn't heard of that. So I don't remember who told me, but it was when we rookied NCSB, and this was going to ask you too. When I rookied NCSB in 2013. They gave us a little booklet of the history of smoke jumping, and not as detailed as your book, but just kind of a quick fact sheet, and they quiz us on it while we're going through rookie training.
Yeah.
Did they have anything like that when you were there?
No, they did not. Matter of fact, I learned about, Man Gulch, the program and the lessons learned that from Man Gulch are used and taught today. I had never heard of Man Gulch, until way later. It was after I got through jumping in 1968.
And a lot of those things just didn't ever really get talked about. I interviewed a fella who, I'm blanking on his name off the top of my head, but he was a firefighter out of California, and he was talking about just like how much death was happening in the first few years, and it was just kind of like seemed to him that they were treating firefighters, wildland firefighters, and I don't think they were maybe called that back then, but it's just like another tool, it wasn't as big a deal to lose one. We didn't have a color guard. He was just talking about just how the culture was back then versus now, and how he's happy to see the change, and then with the Wildland Firefighter Foundation and stuff. But he was talking about a number of big fires and tragedy fires that I'd never heard of, because he was comparing it to, you know, right now we're seeing some extreme fire, and he's like, it's, we've seen this before, you know, it's just no one remembers it. So, you know, kind of like Mangalsch, like if no one talks about it, then it just kind of goes.
The biggest tragedy that occurred during my career that I can remember is my first year. A fellow rookie, he would happen to be my bunkmate, you know, at the bunkhouse. Russell Kleinhexel. He was from Michigan, and he went on he jumped on a large fire. It was, large, probably 200-300 acres.
Yeah.
Bald Mountain was the name of it. And he jumped, and Tony Percival was the spotter, and Tony said, Russ, when he left the airplane, he just froze. He didn't try to guide his parachute, and he ended up in the fire, jumping, you know, into where the trees, it wasn't a roaring fire, but it was, it was definitely a fire.
Yeah.
And he did a letdown, and his feet got hot, and his boots, and he ended up, for some unknown reason, took his boots off.
Oh.
And he, walked, ran out of the fire to the, to the fire line where the other smoke jumpers were, and I saw a report just a week or two ago, where one of the smoke jumpers went down to the, took the trail down to the trailhead and got Forest Service employees to get him and get him out. And I talked to Russ probably 10 years ago. He was living in California at the time, and he said he ended up being in the hospital for a month from his feet.
Jeez. Yeah, that's a hard area to repair. You hear about even like soldiers or even Forest Service folks who, aren't wearing the right socks.
For
whatever reason, just beat their feet up too much. Once you take that layer of skin off the bottom of your foot, it's hard to grow it back.
Yeah.
Man.
But that I'm talking about tragedies, that's that was the most tragic. I do remember having in 1966. Having a DC-3 load of smoke jumpers. I was the squad leader and jumping on a big fire down in the Fremont National Forest. And all I did for 2 hours was just held the crew back. And he said, hey, boys, we're just going to cool it, and I'm going to order air attack. And I just stayed back, and I had a camera. I always carried a camera with me.
Yeah,
and I took pictures, and I have some great pictures of that fire. I have a prize-winning, photo of a B-17 dropping 1,000 gallons of retardant.
Oh wow!
No, I'll show it to you. I'll show you, Luke.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, I'd like to see that. That's awesome. Yeah. That's smart though, right? It was probably too aggressive to really engage.
I landed. Matter of fact, that was one of my worst landings. I landed in a lava field.
Oh boy,
it wasn't solid lava, but it was probably 60-70% lava with some ground in between. And I tried bagging a juniper tree in the field at the last minute. It didn't make it, and I landed. And that was one of my luckiest. Safe, jumps was.
Yeah. Oh man, just do a really good PLF, like roll out of it.
I was concentrating on my legs, putting my feet into rangeland.
Yeah.
and then not doing any landing if I couldn't, but I lost my balance, a little bit of a forward, and I hit my helmet. On the rock, and I was knocked out for, a few seconds. I do distinctly remember that.
Jeez.
And also, it was a 300-acre fire when we jumped. I got some neat pictures from the DC-3 of the of the fire. Pat McCauley was one of the jumpers, and he jumped, and he got caught in the heat from the fire, and he ended up at least 5 minutes in the air, and pretty after a couple of 3 minutes, the embers from the fire were coming up and starting to burn holes in his parachute. So he was well experienced. He was a rookie with me, and he was well experienced. He pulled the risers down and did a slip, to get collapse the parachute partially so he could get out of the heat of the fire.
Yeah, those would have held him up there until the evening, it cooled down.
I got
caught in some up air in California, and it wasn't from the fire, so it wasn't as aggressive, but it was still like the heat of the day, so it was rising off this ridge that we're jumping onto, and it caught me at the last minute. I must have just been on the edge of it, and then as I was coming to the jump spot, it caught me, and I just, like, a little elevator ride just lifted me up, and next thing I know, I'm eye level with the plane again, and it was the Dornier, the doorknob, and I'm like, oh no, I know what this is. And so I just kind of worked my way out of it, just trying to slip out of it, and finally got to the edge of it and got let down. But I jumped with John Spencer, I think was his name, and he was a teacher and a jumper. I don't think he jumps anymore, but he had been jumping for a long time, and he told me about getting some down air and piling in. And I hadn't jumped fire yet. I just got a rookie training. And so he's telling me about the couple times he got down air and broke his ankles, and I think he wrecked his hip or something, and maybe his back. And he's telling me and my rookie bro all this stuff, and I'm like, I haven't been on a fire. I'm like, oh man. So, but it imprinted in my head. So like, I didn't want to try to run out of the up air, because he's where there's up air, there's down air. So I was trying to just work my way out of it. But what was the? I think you told me on the phone, but I can't remember. What was the driving force that made you want to write the book?
Oh, I was always I guess my mother was convinced me about history, and I initially was starting to write a book about the history of Redmond Air Center. Al Boucher, who was the smoke jumper foreman at Redmond, he was always after me to do that because I had an interest in it. So I started, but then as I got going, I thought, hey, there's a lot more happened before Redmond. And so then I started researching that, and that's how I ended up writing, how did smoke jumping, get started? We haven't talked about it, but Russia had a smoke jumping program in 1935 and 1936. That's another subject, but
I talked to Bill a little bit about the exchange, but he didn't mention that, and I briefly saw it in your book that Russia had the jumper program before.
Yes,
and I'm glad you brought that up, because I didn't know the Russians also were the ones who engineered the drogue, right, for what we use in the modern ram air system, right? I thought I read that in your book.
That is true. I forgot about that. Yep.
So it's like, that was really good engineering.
They were really forerunners, in parachute design and development. It's difficult to learn very much about, the Russian program, but, Bill Moody, did some exchange, and also, as Missoula smoke jumper here, I can't think of his name right now. He speaks very fluent Russian.
Oh, really?
And he has talked to some present-day Russian smoke jumpers. And there's some articles in the Smoke Jumper, past issues of Smoke Jumper magazine, where, I can't think of this guy's name right now, but, this...
Was this jumper had talked to?
Yeah.
Interviewed somebody? Or?
Yeah.
Oh, gotcha. Man, that is cool. So, is that kind of what put the idea into Godwin or Good Godwin?
No, not really. Godwin, I tried to get a connection between, did he learn about possibility of smoke jumping from this Ogden, Utah experiment in 1934 and 35?
Yeah.
And
Didn't sound
not
like
really.
Yeah,
I think that the guy, you know, the like, you know, the 1934 35, you know, guy that tried to get it going, you know, he fell out of favor in I believe in the Forest Service. Yeah, here's a harebrained guy. It just, matter of fact, before he even did this, he talked about trying to use hot air balloons, you know, to fly over fires or to over an area or to position a hot air balloon up in the area where lookouts weren't available. And he was ahead of his time. Yeah. Pearson was his name. T.V. Pearson. He went by initials T.V. Hmm. But he was just a little bit, you know, yeah. And when this report was sent up to the Major Kelly, you know, that's how he came about saying, hey, you know, Spunk Jumper, you know, anybody that jumps off a parachute, it's a harebrained idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, yeah. Pearson's probably a little too passionate or too close to the projects. And
yeah.
And anyone who's probably been in a bigger agency, you know, like, it takes a while to get things going, you know. Yeah. I wonder if he was the same fellow, because I read about, I don't think it was in your book, but about using blimps too, and then...
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, blimps, air balloons. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Blimps. I'm sorry, I used the word air balloons. It should have been blimps.
Oh, God, yeah, I thought maybe both.
As like... Yeah, as a matter of fact, he tried it. I don't know if I wrote about that in the book or not.
Yeah, I can't remember where but, I saw it.
Yeah, he when he found out that it would cost something like $70,000 for a blimp back in 1935, and then it would take as many as a dozen people to maneuver and hold the blimp, you know, when it landed, and they needed to have a landing airstrip of, you know, the size of a modern day airstrip,
yeah,
you know, to land and take off. You know, it was just, you know,
I think,
matter of fact, he had written a letter. I have in my files correspondence from the Zeppelin blimp company, you know, writing, exchanging a letter about letters about possibility of using a blimp.
Yeah, because I don't know if that's where I read it or I talked to you about it, but like wherever I got the information, it was talking about the back and forth, and the Zeppelin company was like, what do you need to carry? And it was like beyond what a blimp could carry for cargo, even weight. So,
that's right.
Because I think he was trying to get smoke jumpers or some kind of fire unit in the blimp too with gear, and he's beyond the capabilities of a Zeppelin, it sounded like, at the time. Yeah.
Another, you know, brainy idea, David Godwin. Yeah, this was probably after the Spunk Jumper program was going for, you know, three years. He said, hey, we got to continue to get people into a fire faster. Yeah, so he went to, during World War II, he went to an army air base in Georgia or Kentucky somewhere, where they were experimenting with gliders. You know, because during World War II, you know, they had a glider program, so they could put about 16, you know, infantrymen into a glider, and with a glider pilot and a co-pilot too, would glide then people into a landing, you know, they wouldn't have, you know, wheels on them, but they'd glide into a open, you know, field, and then the infantrymen would get out and, you know, go start shooting their guns.
Yeah.
Well, he thought, hey, we could deliver, you know, firefighters that way. So he went to the, classified, confidential experimental base, and where I forget exactly where it was. I've got I even have the correspondence he wrote about a 5 or 6 page letter about what the possibilities might be. I got a copy of Godwin's official personnel file from the archives, and he has a confidential letter in there that was written about, you know, tells about this whole thing.
Man.
But and they even had, the Army even had a method for picking up these gliders.
I was wondering.
After they were dropped, you know, being able to float a balloon in the air, and a DC-3 could fly over and hook the blimp and take it, not the blimp, the glider, and take it back.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, because the DC-3 in Missoula, did you ever see the last one? It went away in 18, 19? It was here pretty recently. I got to jump out of it. Did you ever see that one?
The one now is Miss Mont.
No, different one. It got sold, and it got the turboprop conversion.
Oh no, I never did have anything that powerful.
Oh really? Yeah, it was so powerful. So a lot of people didn't want to see it go, and it was built towards the end of World War II. So it had really low miles on it, really low hours on it, and then they did the turboprop conversion not long ago on it, and so they had to stretch the fuselage a little bit, and they went through and x-rayed all the parts, all the, you know, major components to make sure it was still good to go. And I mean, it still had a ton of life on it. So we were trying hard to keep it, but you know, the powers that be.
Do you know what year that would have been?
When it went away?
Yeah.
It had to be 19, maybe. I want to say maybe 20. It was shortly after I stopped smoke jumping.
Oh, okay.
So 2019. Yeah,
Dick Holla, who lives here in Missoula, he was a smoke jumper, and he went on to become a smoke jumper pilot.
Oh.
Yeah, he probably did fly that.
I bet it was around for a really long time. Yeah. But it had that hook on the back of it. Because I remember asking, I don't remember if it was the base manager or the pilot or somebody. And they're like, oh, yeah, it was built towards the end of World War II, but the war was ending. So it I don't think it saw any time, but it was built to tow gliders.
Okay.
And I didn't know anything about that glider program. So
yeah, the DC-3 could pull two gliders.
Oh, wow.
Yep, tow them.
That is cool.
An Army buddy of my dad's during World War II was a glider pilot until he was injured, and then he ended up in the quartermaster corps with my dad, and they were close buddies.
That's cool, man. Well, that'd be a cool thing to do.
So I hear about, you know, glider stories a little bit from him.
Yeah. Oh, that'd be cool. A little scary probably at first, you know. I mean, you've got no power behind the sucker, so you just gotta going where you're going. And I was going to ask you, so you were jumping at NCSB, and then when Redmond became a smoke jumper base?
In 1964. I transferred, I had 2 years, and I transferred down to Redmond.
Oh, gotcha.
My primary reason for transferring down there, I was a Salem, Oregon, you know, boy.
Yeah.
And I was going to school at Oregon State nearby Corvallis, and it was just nice to be a little bit closer to home. And
yeah, well,
beautiful. I was kind of poo-pooed for leaving, you know, a great smoke jumper base in Winthrop, Washington, but
it was a good move though. And then
I was there for 1 year. Second year, I think I was Al Boucher selected me as a squad leader, and so I ended up training and as well as leading, you know, serving as a squad leader in larger fires, and did a lot of spotting.
Oh, very cool. Yeah, probably a really good experience. Yeah. And is that the same spot that it was back then?
Yes, yeah.
So it probably hasn't changed much either.
It's got still the original buildings. They've added a couple more buildings.
Yeah, man, that's cool. Yeah, because I've been there quite a bit. And then NCSB, has that changed since you were there?
Yeah, a little bit. I don't think a whole lot, though.
Yeah,
the cook shack that we had there is burned down.
Oh, it did.
Yeah, and sometime after I left.
Oh, gotcha. And they replaced that.
Yeah, the bunkhouse. Last time I was there, it's been 5-6 years ago now. They had a memorial service for Doug Houston there.
Oh yeah.
Doug Houston was base manager for a while at North Cascades, and I got to know him pretty well. But when I went there, there wasn't a lot of changes.
That's what I liked about it too, because I hadn't been back until this summer to interview Bill Moody. Mm-hmm. I hadn't been back since 13 when I rookied, so it was really cool to go back. And there was some kind of little like it looks almost like a construction like a foreman booth thing that's kind of there, but it's kind of more temporary, and it's near the kind of the warehouse building. Like if you're going from where the base manager office and all that is, it's and going to the bunkhouse. It's kind of on your right side there. Huh. And I think it's for the pilots now. I think maybe it's like a pilot shack or something they built, but it's not, it doesn't look like it's permanent. So it might not even live there in the winter, but that was the only thing that I noticed that was different since I was there. And it's really nice. I like that it hasn't changed. So did we stay in the same bunkhouse then? Was it like a big long Quonset hut?
Yeah. Yeah. The first, I was in the first bunkhouse next to the Quonset hut. And,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Jack Fitzgerald and I were assigned the task of building a saw shack.
Oh, really?
You know, they're kind of a carpenter, saw shack, you know, store tools and do repair work and chainsaws. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's probably still the same one.
Then. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's still, it was, last time I was there, it was still there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jack and I, we weren't very good carpenters. We were proud of ourselves, probably, or ashamed of ourselves, probably used twice as much lumber as we needed to, because we would, you know, cut before we had measure.
Yeah, yeah. Measure once, cut twice. That's kind of my
carpentry
skill.
We did the opposite.
You're supposed to measure twice, cut once, and yeah, I'm the opposite as well. And my dad's a carpenter, so he's probably a little ashamed of me. But you did a great job. I mean, the extra lumber maybe it made it stay as long as it has.
Oh yeah,
you
know?
It still looks good. In you know, the shoulder seat, towards the end of my rookie season, I spent a lot of time in there just helping tune up saws or winterize saws.
Okay. That's where it was.
Oh, beautiful.
I heard they got rid of the torture rack, though.
They did, yeah. I haven't seen a torture rack anywhere, actually, in person. I think I ever got rid of them.
Yeah, we always, yeah.
Is it brutal as it looks in the pictures?
Yeah, it is. I remember straining a knee once a little bit.
Oh, I bet.
Minor. Yeah, I had to. Took me a few days to, you know, get it back in shape. But
Will they time you guys? So it's like a big log kind of that you're like have a strap around you and you lean way back. Right?
Yeah. You lean back and touch your, you know, strap behind your knees.
Oh, behind your knees. Yeah.
And you lean back and touch your head on the.
Oh.
On the ground behind you.
I don't know if I'm built for that. I'm not very flexible. That would have been really hard on me. Yeah. And how long would they have you do it? Just until you touched or hold
it?
Oh,
I'd probably do it, you know, 10, 15 reps.
Oh, really? Just down and up and down and up? Yeah. Oh, man, yeah, it looks brutal from the photos.
Yeah, that's one of the exercises I think they've done away with.
Yeah, that one's gone now. But I think a lot of it's kind of still the same, you know, like the letdowns and, tower exits and PLFs.
Yeah, speaking of letdowns, during the 1939 experiment, when they went into that, they figured when the experiment started, everybody's going to land in an opening area.
Yeah.
And they didn't figure that they'd ever need to, land in... you know, in trees, you know, and get out of them.
Yeah.
And that's how Francis Lufkin and Dick Tuttle ended up being retrieving not only parachutes, but also men out of trees.
Oh.
And I have a picture of Francis Lufkin climbing up one of the trees to retrieve one of the jumpers that was hung up.
Oh, whoa.
But, you know, that was one of the, you know, things that, you know, they had to develop and figure out how are we going to get out of these trees? So they had a procedure established, but it was you'd have so much pressure, your weight, you know, would be on such a concentrated point. It was hard to figure out how to lift yourself up, and be able to hook off onto your risers.
Yep. Yeah, even during training.
And before that, you know, and that when they jumped in 1939, as well as for a few years after that, the Eagle parachute didn't have disconnected risers. The harness was connected, sewed directly to the risers on the parachute.
Oh.
So when you got out of a tree, you had to be able to unhook, you know, your buckles from around your legs.
Yeah.
You know, you had to lift up enough to get out.
And get the whole harness off to get yourself out.
Yeah, you had to take your harness off to get out of the parachute.
Oh,
even
wow.
If you landed on the ground and the wind was pulling you, you still had to, you know, get yourself unhooked from the harness.
Oh man!
You know, the chest strap and the leg strap, the three critical places, you know, buckles to get unbuckled.
That had to be a problem, because
yeah.
I jumped just a practice jump in a pretty windy spot, and even one of the guys who'd been jumping for over 5 years at that point was like, after the jump, he's like, that was a sporty jump, and I was like, oh, that was just me. But it was, we had quite a wind going there, and then I hit the ground. It was dragging me through like some kind of sagebrush, mm-hmm. and for me, it was just Cape Wells. Was it Cape Wells for you?
Yeah, Cape Wells, yeah.
Yeah, and I every time I got a hold of one, the sagebrush would hit my hand and knock it down because I was just getting funneled through it all. So I was scratching like a wildcat trying to get it off. And finally I did, but it took me, I mean, it probably dragged me for like 50 yards.
Yeah.
And I couldn't imagine trying to get off a full harness. I was just trying to pop some Cape Wells.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and when I was jumping, I was 62 when I started. It was sometime in probably mid-50s that the Cape Well came to be.
Oh, yeah.
I haven't been able to determine exactly when or what year, because in World War II, the Rangers did not have Cape Wells.
Oh.
You know, they had the same type of harnesses that we're just talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they finally figured out, well, we got to have some way of being able to get quicker out of these harness. So then they developed, I think Frank Derry was probably instrumental in developing this. They used a couple of snap rings, snap hooks, in lieu of what now is the Cape Well. You know, so you could, all you had to do was to unhook. It's like a horse harness.
Oh.
You unsnap that, you know, and those two, and then you're able to still have your suit, harness on, but the chute you'd disconnect from the parachute. And that made it a lot easier to do letdowns, too.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I couldn't imagine, like, especially if you're on a not-so-sturdy snag or something, you know. And...
Oh, yeah, it was hell trying to, you know, get out of a... You know, those harness, that harness, you know, that was, it didn't take but probably 2 or 3 years at the most of my research that they developed this snap for being able to, you know, get out of, disconnect your parachute quickly.
Yeah, geez, makes sense. Man, that's another question I was going to ask you about, smoke jumping, but I don't want to keep you all night. So
that's okay.
I was going to say, maybe I'll have to do a follow-up with you, Fred, but I had a kind of an off-topic question, but D.B. Cooper's, I didn't connect him to smoke jumping until I went to Redmond my rookie year, and there was a bunch of articles at the Redmond smoke jumper base about D.B. Cooper and the thought that maybe the investigators thought he could have been a smoke jumper, because at the time, there wasn't that many trained parachute folks in the nation, I guess, and based on him doing a tree jump and the location in the Pacific Northwest and two jump bases in the area, I heard there was they were thinking it was highly likely that he could have been a smoke jumper at some point. Mm-hmm. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, yeah, very much so. Matter of fact, I was living in Seattle at the time that hijacking took place.
Oh.
Yeah, that year was probably 1972 or so. I can't remember the exact year, but about 1971 or 2 or 3. And it was right after Thanksgiving, or right around that period of time. And I was told that the FBI had contacted Redmond, because I had been a smoke jumper and I had the last name Cooper. And so I was
On the list?
On the list, yeah. But luckily, I was on the short list.
Oh, good, yeah.
And, yeah. Yeah, you know, I was looked into, but I think it was just very quickly. They never talked to me personally.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, because I guess Larry was on the list too, and I talked to him about it, I think, off the podcast, but not on it. And I meant to talk about it on the podcast just because I think it's an interesting story. And,
yeah.
You know, there's a movie made about it, you know, like not long ago, you know, a bunch of goofballs are going to the woods to find D.B. Cooper.
But at that time, it's real easy, you know, to get onto the airplane. I remember one of my first commercial airplane flight was out of Seattle, out of Boeing Field. And there was no air terminal to speak of. You go in and you check in and you walk from the terminal out to the airplane and walk onto the airplane. I was in a short flight from Seattle to Eugene.
Oh.
And I can see where it would have been really easy for D.B. Cooper,
yeah,
or whoever it was,
yeah,
to get on and nonchalantly take a parachute with him. And a few thousand dollars.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and I think it was Larry who was telling me that when he's having conversations with his dad, Francis, about it, I think it was Francis was saying just like the amount of jet propulsion coming off that thing and the speed.
Yeah.
He was thinking that that DB probably got wrapped up in his parachute and
turned
into a burrito and his body's still out in the woods somewhere.
Based on our experience, jumping, it would not be easy.
Yeah.
To survive something like that. Yeah. I don't know what the speed would have been, but it would have been probably at least 200 miles an hour.
That's what I was thinking for a big airliner like that. It can't slow down enough, I wouldn't think.
I think they jumped out of the back of the airplane. I forget what airplane it was. So.
Yeah.
So it would have, kind of been sucked out too, and so it wouldn't have been going out sideways like we were going out.
Yeah.
Except now, I guess, other Sherpas, they jump from the tail end?
Yeah, they still were jumping out the side door when I was there. And last I heard, I know they were talking about maybe because the Sherpa B had the capabilities of lowering that back hatch and the CASA, they jump at the CASA in NCSB as well. And they're able to lower it and lift it. But I think still just like operationally, it makes more sense to do the side door thing.
Okay.
Getting a good view of the fire and stuff. And
yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. I'd use my camera. I usually have my camera either in my leg pocket inside my hard hat or to protect it or around my neck.
Oh, yeah.
And I took a few pictures while I'd be in the door waiting. And especially if they had to make another extra run, I'd unzip my coat a little bit and jacket and take a few pictures. And I got some neat pictures I have to show you of.
Yeah. I'd love to see them because that's very cool. I meant to tell you the Stinson, you're saying it went to Alaska maybe after.
The Stinson Reliant. Yeah.
Do you know where it is? I know where it is now. Do you know?
No, I don't.
I just found out because I went to go look for Francis Lovkin's jumpsuit, the red one, because Bill didn't know where it had gone, and we were talking about him doing the jump in like the 80s or something with it.
Yeah.
And I was like, I actually have no idea. I contacted Larry, and Larry was the one who told me it was in Missoula, he thought. And it was Kim Maynard who jumped out of Missoula. She was like the second female smoke jumper in the 80s. Really cool gal, tough.
Yeah, second or third. Yeah, I know her quite well.
Yeah. Her and her rookie sis are kind of tied for a second, I think, is kind of how it go. I believe is what she was telling me. But so she and her husband actually tracked it down at the Evergreen Museum up by where Larry lives, and brought it to Missoula Mountain Flying Museum? Museum of Mountain Flying.
Museum of Mountain, yeah. It's in the museum there now.
Yeah, and then I found out, too, that Larry was one replica made in NCSB, never quite found the time, and Missoula took some measurements, but I think...
I loaned it. I had it in my possession.
Oh, really?
And I have pictures of me in it.
Oh, very cool.
But it's... I gave it to somebody at Missoula Smoke Jumper Base, you know, to use to develop, make a prototype or a duplicate.
Yeah.
But it never got done.
Well, I found out it did recently.
Oh, it did. Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I'd be interested to learn about that.
Yeah. I've been meaning to go to the jump base to visit with him because it was, I think, Aaron Thorpe. There's two Thorpe brothers who jump now, and I believe it's Aaron's the one here in Missoula. And he liked the red jumpsuit so much that he made the replica and also made some upgrades from the original, that suit in his jumpsuit. So I want to see what his jumpsuit looks like as well.
Is that replica at the Missoula jump base?
As far as I know, I talked to Thorpe kind of briefly about it. I've been meaning to get over to the jump base, but I haven't been. And that was a couple months ago when I talked to him. So I believe they did make the replica because I think they're going to have it on display at the visitor center there. Or maybe they're making it for the museum. I don't know.
I'm involved quite heavily in the, you know, the design of the
new museum there.
Yeah, museum. You know, of the what are we going to show and present? And there isn't going to be a whole lot of room for a swoon jumper.
Oh.
Yeah. Matter of fact, the one item that I'm working towards getting in there is an eagle parachute that was manufactured in 1939.
Oh.
It has the stamp panel on it from 1939. It's a Eagle Parachute Corporation, and the original name is crossed out and written Forrester C in it.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
Stamped. You know, it's not handwritten, but stamped.
Oh.
And that parachute was used for probably 1940 to 42 or 43 until it determined not operational anymore, because it has repair holes in it where it's been cut or torn by landing in trees, and also small holes where zigzag, where they've sewn up a grasshopper holes, because the silk parachute, but the first thing they did when they landed, with the silk parachute, was to gather it up and put it in the bag so the grasshoppers wouldn't get to it. Otherwise, they'd just, riddle it up real fast.
Yeah, Swiss cheese that sucker, huh?
Yeah.
I didn't know. Yeah. Huh. Because I knew they were silk for a minute, but I didn't know why they made the effort to change it out so quickly. But
yeah,
I thought it was the war, maybe. But
well, it was the design. But nylon, I researched this, and nylon didn't come into being until later 1940s. I forget the exact year now. It was sooner than what I thought it would be. So that's when the nylon parachute started. It came into first thing it was built was the nylon hose for women.
Oh,
for ladies.
Yeah, yeah. Well, oh, gotcha.
And then
that makes sense. You know, like if you think back, especially like in those old movies, you saw like the nylon leggings, and man, that's funny. Tough, I guess. And then I guess I forgot to finish the Stinson story. So but it's so easy because so much information, man. That's why I'm loving talking to you, Fred. The fellas who run the Museum of Mountain Flying here in Missoula,
Eric Combrick.
Think maybe his son?
Eric is the son.
Oh, Eric that I talked to.
And the father, he passed away in the last year.
Oh.
Dick Combrick.
Oh, Dick.
Yeah, but Eric Combrick is, he's restoring a Stinson, but I talked to him about it several years ago. He has it at his place up in Kalispell, but he... as I understand, it's not the original. What he has done is gotten FAA certification or approval to use the original Stinson number.
Oh.
You know, on the one that he's reconstructing.
Oh, because he told me he found the original and then had to look up the paint scheme and get permission for the paint scheme too.
Okay.
So. I don't know if you actually found the original. I'll have to bug him now again.
We need to talk. I need to talk to him about that too.
Yeah, because I thought that was really interesting.
I haven't seen him for about a year.
Yeah, and I wonder. I wonder if he has that plane and maybe he has the.
Well, it, you know, I was in it, and I, it's my understanding that it is not the original.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. I wonder if he has two then, because it sounded like it was more recent that he found.
Maybe he found the original.
That's what I'm wondering. Yeah, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I heard him wrong.
Because I got into that airplane and on the strut where he jumped from. Judas Priest, you know, being in a one-piece suit with foam padding, a jumper would have had to been almost lifted up into position and helped out in order to jump. You know, that, I don't know if you've, have you ever seen one of those?
No, I haven't.
Oh, jeez.
No
small
room. Well, I didn't realize the beach was so small until I saw it at the museum there in Missoula, too.
The
museum.
Twin Beach?
Yeah.
Oh, I love that plane to jump out of.
Little guy, though. Like, it's a cool-looking aircraft.
I have 73 Forest Service parachute jumps, and probably half of them are from the Twin Beach and the other half from the DC-3.
Oh, really? Man, those are the best planes, I think.
Yeah.
In my opinion. And they're both, I think, and just for the look, too. Like, they both look like smoke jumper aircrafts to me,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't know. The beach
you're
smaller.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That Twin Beach looks really small now.
It does, yeah. Cause I thought, and I didn't know because I hadn't seen one, so I always thought it was the same size as the DC-3. So
oh, yeah.
So then I saw one. I was like, oh, all right.
Yeah, it's about a fourth the size.
Yeah. And I found out, and tell me if I'm wrong, but the jumpers would kind of stack in and sit between each other's legs.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yep. I've got pictures of the inside, of, you know, me in one of them. Yeah.
No chairs or anything, just empty? And...
Oh, yeah. There'd be some benches on the side.
Oh, bench on the side. Oh, gotcha.
At least on one side.
Is it as tall as the Airstream here, or is it?
Oh, no. Oh, no. It's, no, no, you can't stand up in it.
That's what I was thinking, but I wasn't sure.
Oh, yeah. No, you. It's maybe at the most two-thirds the height of this.
Oh, maybe like the height of our heads right now, maybe?
A little bit higher.
A little bit higher. Oh, yeah. Gosh. A little bit of room to move, but not yeah. A bunch. Because yeah, that's the Twin Otter. Did you ever get one of those?
No, never did.
That was probably the smallest aircraft I jumped out of. I mean, the Dornier is pretty small, but the Twin Otter felt like really tight.
Oh.
I a lot of folks like jumping out of it because it's got a nice airspeed, slows down nicely, mm-hmm. and a lot of them have big windows, so you can get a good view. And it's so narrow, when it tips, you can see out really well, too, you know, when they're doing the orbit. Mm. But I didn't like it because it was so tight. You know, you'd be wedged in there, and it'd get hot, and... I guess I was spoiled because the cost is pretty roomy, and then getting the jump out of the DC-3 as well.
Yeah, the DC-3 is, you know, of course, lots of room.
It's amazing. Yeah. I'm so lucky I got to jump out of that. Well, I'll let you go, Fred, but I wanted to ask, the Redmond book is still in the works, right?
Yes, it is, and it's available for purchase from the National Smoke Jumper Association website in their bookstore page.
Wait, the Redmond one is?
The Redmond. I'm sorry. No, the Redmond is, the book is not out yet.
Oh, gotcha.
Matter of fact, I need to follow up with the guy who I passed the baton to see where he's at with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really interested to read that. I'm interested to get through this one. But you said this one's available through
this one is available through the National Smoke Jumper Association website in their bookstore.
Yeah, Smoke Jumper Experiment. I highly recommend checking it out for folks listening. Great read, great information.
Yep. 16 stories of, you know, brief biographies of the 16 men as it related to this experiment.
I'm so glad you did the book, because...
It's got pictures in it, and Mike did a great job of not only doing the editing and layout. He did the layout for it and lined up the printer and also writing the epilogue about the Ram Air.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's a great finish having the epilogue and the photos, too, you know, because the photos and how the Ram Air system works, too.
Yeah.
It was very cool to see it. I don't think there'll be another book as good.
That matter of fact, this one guy here, Walt Anderson, his granddaughter was one of the first people to have purchased this book.
She
was so proud to see her grandfather there.
That is cool. Well, this might be one of the first books I was ever given and with an inscription, so I'm going to cherish that, Fred. I really appreciate that,
well,
man.
Well, you're welcome.
Yeah, my daughter's really, really into books right now, and every time I get a book, she's like, my book? So I had to wrestle that away from her to get reading on it.
Mike, designed this so it'd be an easy read, and somebody could carry, smoke jumpers, or anybody could carry around with them and read a little bit and pick it up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks, Fred. Thanks for sharing your time.
Okay.
I'm going to check out that photo before we leave.
One thing I did want to mention, about you mentioned women, in the smoke jumping program, it was the Russians who had the first woman smoke jumper in 1936.
Whoa, I did not know that.
Yeah.
So they've had women smoke jumpers since the beginning, pretty much.
Well, I don't know after that, but that was... And their smoke jumping program was, of course, a lot different. That's another story we can talk about. But they jumped into open fields and they would round up the villagers, to hike several miles out to the fire.
Oh, whoa.
And tell them how to fight fire.
Coach them along with it. I think it was Eric maybe or who was... Oh, no, it's Bill who was talking about the smoke jumper plane that they were flying and might still be using. One that he got to jump out of, I think, was like a giant-looking biplane.
Oh, okay.
Did you ever see the photos of them?
Mm-mm, no.
Man, they look really cool. And I guess they're pretty slow, but a lot of horsepower and real functional. So I guess they might be still in use over there. And
okay.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. But I guess that's all I got. Well, thanks again, Fred. I appreciate you. Then thanks for tuning in, everybody.